the boats that go out to sea, they use some of the worst possible fuels that you can imagine. And I remember reading that the boats that come to Auckland, you know, the cruise boats that come in, actually create more pollution than all the cars in New Zealand put together. So the more that we can do to turn boats into electric vehicles, the better.
The New Zealand Tech Podcast, brought to you by Gorilla Technology, proactive and strategic IT.
Greetings and welcome along to the New Zealand Tech Podcast. I'm your host, Paul Spain. And today, very nice to have Bill Bennett back in the Podcast NZ studios here in Auckland. How are you, Bill?
I'm good, Paul.
Very, very nice to catch up. Of course, before we start, a big thank you to our wonderful show partners for keeping things rolling. 1NZ, 2 Degrees, Spark, HP and Gorilla Technology. Now, some pretty important news and I guess opportunities to share some opinion today. But let's start with the local New Zealand topics, and then we'll go into to some of these big global stories and how the tech world as we know it in some areas may well be coming to something of an end.
Oh, it's a flipping point, yeah.
Yeah. Very, very interesting time in history. But first up, locally, yeah, we're going through this journey as I guess most of the world is, where transportation, you know, will move from using, you know, traditional, generally, you know, fossil fuels to renewable as much as possible. And, you know, part of the way that happens is by largely moving to electric. And of course, this is across, you know, not just private transport, but public transport. And one of those public transport mechanisms, of course, that we rely on is ferries. And so we've had news that there's going to be a further delay on Auckland's fleet of electric ferries. And there's two types that are coming that will be owned by Auckland Transport. I understand, certainly the hybrids are owned by them. So there's these two hybrid electric ferries, and they will take 300 passengers. And then there's also 200-person fully electric ferries. And I think, you know, what we're looking at here is ones that will be operated by Fullers, who large, you know, do a large percentage of the ferry fleet in New Zealand. But yeah, we've had some delays along the way, and interestingly, one of the challenges that they've had relates to the batteries, and that's what's causing this latest delay. They were originally going to go for air-cooled batteries, but of course, being on a boat, they also need to be, you know, pretty waterproof, pretty watertight. Yeah. And that's where they sort of got into challenges, and, you know, ultimately they've kind of changed course midstream. They're getting batteries out of the US and have chosen to change to a water-cooled battery, which to me sort of sounds pretty logical if you're building a ferry, right? And, you know, when you talk around fast charging and these sorts of things, there's going to be a range of benefits of that sort of approach.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the boats themselves are being built here in New Zealand, so it's just the batteries that are coming from overseas. I'm one of the people who used to catch the ferry an awful lot. When I worked in town, I would catch the ferry every day from Birkenhead to the city. It's a much more enjoyable way of getting to and from work. You certainly avoid the traffic on Onewa Road. If you're in Auckland, you'll know about Onewa Road. But
well, getting out on the water is one of those lovely things in life, right? So if you can make that part of your daily commute, even better.
You arrive at work in a completely different state of mind. But one of the things about it is the journey is kind of relaxing and so on, but it's noisy with the diesel, and that's quite jarring. You know, first thing in the morning, the noise of that, and of course with the electric versions, they'll be floating gently across. Well, not they'll be floating fast, but it'll be a much more sort of gentle introduction to the day and the end of the day, which will be just lovely. And also because where I live, we can hear the Hobsonville ferry go past sometimes, because I'm not far from the water myself, and I don't think I'll hear it at all when the electric ones come in. So that's all great from that point of view. It's great. I I'm quite excited about the using electric power for ferries and boats in general because, you know, the challenges of getting batteries light enough for aeroplanes is really quite something, you know, because they've got to lift off the ground. But because ferries float on the water, it's a lot easier to make them electric from that point of view. You don't have to worry so much about the weight of the batteries, which has always been the challenge with other forms of transport. So the potential for boats is just huge. And the other thing about boats is that not necessarily ferries that go around Auckland, but the boats that go out to sea, they use some of the worst possible fuels that you can imagine. And I remember reading somewhere that the boats that come to Auckland, you know, the cruise boats that come in, actually create more pollution than all the cars in New Zealand put together. So,
wow.
So the more that we can do to turn boats into electric vehicles, the better.
Well, there's some interesting, you know, dynamics there, I guess, as you compare the different types of transport. The cars and, in most cases, the buses seem to work pretty well. Trucks, I think we probably haven't seen quite the same pickup on the trucking front. There's some challenges there with the weight of the loads and the distances, although, you know, the first, and it's a pretty small number, you know, of electric trucks that you know, Tesla have sold, you know, apparently that's working quite well. And there is certainly a bunch of the electric trucks out there. There's, you know, folks that have been, you know, trained up now for a number of years and servicing them and maintaining them. So all of that sort of side of things keeps going. But on the water, you know, that has been quite challenging due to different challenges from you know, certainly aircraft, but, you know, still some challenges. And I went out, we talked about this probably on episode sort of maybe, you know, 18 months back on a Hamilton jet, you know, powered boat. And the Hamilton jet we're using is sort of a demo. And it was very much sort of the hybrid approach because for the sort of long periods of time that folks in some cases will need to be out in boats, then that's a challenge. But I see there's approaches, you know, to that where we're kind of seeing these electric sailboats that are, you know, going to generate electricity and so on. So that it looks like there's a lot of opportunity ahead for innovation. But the ferries that are just going the sort of, you know, shorter distances as we generally see around Auckland, it's almost perfect.
Yeah, distance is the thing, because I talked to a freight company and they said that electric's good for up to, if your vehicle's doing less than 200 kilometres a day, electric's good. If you're, and so what that basically means is that around town it works, but between cities it's just not the way to go at the moment.
It's interesting to see. And I guess that, you know, when it comes to the electric cars, I think that side's got a lot better because there's so many more chargers. You know, even though we've had recent news of Tesla laying off largely their EV charging team, they've, you know, massively increased theirs. We've got, you know, Z Energy, who have now got a lot of fast chargers around the country, although I did see somebody making a little bit of fun of them. It must have been Tuesday today as we record around. Maybe it was chargers that they had at the Bombay Hills that were turned off because apparently Z do free charging on Tuesdays at the moment to promote their network. But if their best and fast chargers aren't working, then that seems a little unhelpful. Yeah. Anyway, so that side of it's improved, and getting around the country, you know, I've been largely around the country. Probably only the part that there are one or two places that are still a little bit of a challenge, but I think those issues will largely evaporate. So, yep, it's great to see things moving on the water when it comes to our ferries.
I think there's also a problem that they haven't got the chargers in the ferry stations yet as well, which is an issue. But the fact that it's going to take longer for the batteries to turn up means they've got longer to build those chargers.
Yeah. So. Now, also, when it comes to some pretty interesting tech, is Ocean Flyer.
Oh, yeah.
Now, this you know, company to me sounds like a whole lot of fun and, you know, pretty incredible if, you know, if it all comes together with this startup. Now, there have been reports over, you know, just very recently now that Ocean Flyer have raised some significant funds, I think $145 million through, what is it, a US investor, Monty.
UK investor.
Oh, UK, yeah, sorry, yeah, UK, yeah. Yep. And then working with a US-based manufacturer,
yeah,
Regent, with this goal of bringing 25 sea gliders to New Zealand. And of course, this is, you know, this is the electric, I guess the electric planes within the realm of where they might work very, very well.
Yeah, well, they don't go very high, they don't go very far, but they just skim across the water. But if you remember, if you think back to the America's Cup, that's what was happening with the catamarans anyway. They were, in effect, flying rather than sailing as such. Mm, I mean, most of the time they were above the waves.
Yep.
And I think these are similar to that in some respects. So they're not flying in the sense that, you know, you catch a Boeing to Sydney from Auckland. They're flying in the sense that they're like 10 metres above the waves.
Yeah, look, I'm really curious to see how this plays out. So this $145 million that understand that they've received has put them in a position to basically order 15 of these 12-seater sea gliders and 10 which are up to 100 seats. So it's a quite different sort of, you know, two very different.
Yeah, I'd like to see them on different
scales.
I think they're quite fast as well, aren't they?
Yeah, I'm not sure quite what their top speeds are. What do we got? 300 kilometres an hour,
yeah,
when
that's
they're
fast.
Flying,
yeah,
10 metres above the water.
Oh, that's going to be a thrill. So
yeah, that would, I mean, especially that close to the water, boy,
yeah,
that's something else.
No, that'd be really exciting.
Yeah, yeah. So they're talking a $50 to $60 airfare, Auckland to Northland, 35 to 40 minutes. I mean, that seems like a game changer. If you can, you know, if you're already in the city, you don't have to go out to the airport. And I don't know the realities of exactly how they'll do this stuff.
Do you know what I'd do? I'd go up there for lunch.
Yeah. That's true. So yeah, really, really cool. So good to see, you know, some neat stuff happening locally. And, you know, this is the nature, I guess, of you know, everything is being transformed in the world by technology in one form or another, and our transport is part of that. Okay, now on to the sort of the big global topics. We have delved into it, actually. Neuralink, which, you know, this computer-brain interface, and I think we talked a little bit about the chap who was the first human to receive this technology as an actual brain implant, not just a situation where it was monkeys, wasn't it? Was the previous thing, monkeys playing Pong. And so now it's you know, it's gone to a real human. But then we read, well, actually there were issues with these little wires, and, you know, we're told to think of them as hairs, very, very fine wires that you know, link up with the brain as part of the interface. And your story was that, you know, that had a bunch of issues there. We've now seen a bit of content with people saying, look, you know, these issues go back actually years and years of this sort of shrinkage. And you know, one thing that I read sort of referred to it a little bit like a, you know, heart transplant and the you know, or some sort of transplant, and the new organ being rejected, that there was kind of an element of that. So it does leave me wondering, is this, you know, idea of the, you know, brain interface going to be something that really, really works long term, or does it just last for a short while and it's going to need sort of constant attention to reset it up?
This is the thing that worries me about this. The tech industry is great when it comes to the actual innovation side of things, but all of us, any of us who've spent our lives dealing with tech, know just how awful customer support can be.
Yeah.
Right. And it's one thing to have poor customer support when your smartphone needs fixing and you've got to wait a couple of days.
Mm.
But if the link to your brain isn't working for days and you're on hold waiting for someone to fix it or whatever, that just terrifies me. And I think that's the problem that I can see with this, is that you know, if you go to the health sector, they look at customer support in a completely different way. They have customer support experts that are called nurses, you know, and their job
what
is
a great to, idea, Bill.
Yeah, but you know what I'm saying? That the I just don't want to be on hold for 16 hours. Something is connected to my brain.
Well, on the flip side, with the medical sector, we do have the issues and the oddities where the medical sector rolls out some technology and then never patches it and secures it. So I guess neither side always gets these things perfect. But yeah, I think just something to be aware on to balance our enthusiasm if that's something that you were waiting on for yourself or a family member. I think these things are maybe a little bit more complicated.
I think it's the sort of thing where you don't want to be an early adopter.
Well, I mean, this chap, the chap that was featured as the first person, he seemed pretty stoked to be the early adopter at the beginning. I think it'd be interesting to see how that plays out, you know, over time. And I guess we would all hope that it works out, you know, very, very well. But your risk being one of the early adopters is higher. And then, look, we may find over time actually that some of these risks aren't able to be fully addressed.
Yeah. You know, I think I'd want that technology to bed well down before it got anywhere near anyone close to me.
Now, gaming. How do you feel about gaming, Bill? Do you do any gaming these days?
Not really. I haven't really been done gaming for 40 odd years. I did. I was there right at the beginning with the 8-bit gaming.
Yeah.
But since then, I just haven't really had time in my life for it. There's too much else going on.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, no, gaming's not my thing.
Well, we've seen this news come out, research from Auto Trader, revealing that there's a link between playing video games and driving skills. And I guess so that brings us to the questions, are gamers, you know, better drivers? And apparently those who play particularly, you know, driving games, but you wonder, you know, whether there's something in it to do with sort of general dexterity if you're playing, you know, appropriate sort of games. But certainly those that are playing driving type games, apparently they accumulate significantly less demerit points.
Well, that's interesting because I just said I'm not much of a gamer, but when I have played these games, I get the impression those driving games teach you to be more of a risk taker.
Well, that might just be your take on it, Bill.
Well, that's
you might just go nuts when it's like, I can go really crazy.
Well,
here
exactly, but also if you want to win the game, then you do generally have to take more risks. So I was thinking, you know, perhaps that's, but clearly not. That's not the case. Perhaps they're people actually learning from the experience.
Yeah, okay. It could also increase your confidence because in their survey they said an impressive 41% of gamers rated their driving skills as excellent, which was quite a contrast to just 13% of non-gamers who felt the same about their ability. So I don't know whether that actually talks to increased, you know, driving skills, although the report on the demerit points suggests it does. And of course, then there's all sorts of other things. Is, you know, can you correlate? Was it because they were driving, or was there some, you know, are there some other factors for if you look at that group who, you know, who drive in a video game and also drive better? Is that the actual reason?
Well,
for
I also
it or
wonder
not?
If playing those games makes you better at stealing cars, which is quite often features.
Right. So you might not be getting demerit points if you get caught on camera in a stolen vehicle.
Yeah.
All right. That's another take on it, Bill, that I hadn't thought about up front. Okay, now to the big stuff. You know, a few weeks ago, Bill, you and I were with HP for their launch of new PCs, Intel-based PCs in Sydney. You know, we left there having learnt some sort of insights in terms of what was happening with Intel chips in, you know, Windows computers, some understanding around the NPU, the neural processing units, and their ability to carry out artificial intelligence type, you know, type functions on your local device rather than necessarily having to do things in the cloud. Now, today, the picture has been filled in more clearly because this is something we've known has been coming, but now we've kind of got the big announcement from Microsoft. And, I think
that Sydney trip was like the John the Baptist thing, wasn't it? Get ready for this.
Get ready for this, yeah. And, yeah, and interestingly, that event, you know, I guess I saw the Intel logo there and the devices being announced were very much Intel devices. But today's big news from Microsoft and, you know, everything that they've showed off in Seattle today is about what is a really big change for our industry. And we don't use the term much these days of Wintel, but that is effectively the technology that the majority of desktop and laptop computer users have used for, you know, a generation, right?
So,
you know,
yeah,
this has been, we look back to, it was the late 80s, or it was probably mid 80s actually, but the late 80s was probably the period where I got my hands on Microsoft technology and Intel technology.
Do you remember the time when things like Word 6 came along and you needed to get a new processor to be able to run it?
Oh, did you? Okay.
Because it was, you know, it required that much more power, and there was this kind of cycle of Microsoft would up the ante with pack more things into the software.
Yep.
And the hardware wasn't quite keeping pace with what was going on.
Yeah, certainly the what we used to call WinWord, right? The Windows version of Word was, it needed a lot of grunt. And look, so Intel have served us very well from, you know, the 80s to today. But as I was discussing on Radio New Zealand this afternoon, we've had a major, actually a big frustration for a long time, and that's the battery life of our portable devices. And this is why, or is one of the reasons why, and there's a bit more to it, but why Apple moved to running their own silicon rather than Apple silicon, what are we, about 3 years or so back now?
Yeah, well, I was thinking about that from a different point of view when earlier, and that was that for a long time, you could kind of tell the Wintel thing was on its way out because we talked a moment ago about how there's that cycle of Windows or Office being upgraded and you needed a new processor because it was getting more powerful all the time. And at that stage, each generation was actually a kind of big step forward. You know, the chips have been much, much faster. But over, the last decade, maybe more than a decade, it's been very incremental and you barely notice the hardware getting faster from one machine to another until Apple moved to Apple Silicon. And the first time I got my hands on an M1 MacBook, and I just thought, wow, you know, wow. And even recently, we'll talk about this perhaps a bit later. I just had my hands on the new MacBook Air, and it's gone from a M2 to an M3 processor. And it's about a 20% speed increase. Well, when's the last time Intel's chips went up by 20% in a year from 1 year to the next? It didn't happen. So you could kind of see that Intel's competitiveness as the processor was plateauing and it wasn't really going anywhere. And it hasn't been for some time. And as you say, the battery life thing was just, it was revelation when going to the Apple M1. Silicon, same thing. I had two computers at home. I had a beautiful Windows laptop, which would go for maybe 3 hours. And I had a MacBook Air, which I could get 20 hours out of. Well, there's kind of no comparison in terms of utility and so on. And that kind of said everything about how far behind Intel was. And I think that Intel is probably more than a generation behind the ARM chips at the moment. I mean, I'm not saying it can't pick up. Of course it can. It's, you know, it's technology. You can always change things.
Yeah.
But this is kind of the culmination of all that's been happening over the last 3 or 4 years with PCs and chips. Is it happened today with the announcement of these ARM-based Windows machines.
Yeah, so if we look back to, it was end of 2020, that first MacBook with the M1 came out. And if we look at sort of the underlying technology that Apple's chips are using, the Qualcomm Snapdragon X Elite, which is going to be the primary chip, the X Elite and the slower X Plus. So those are the two chips. All of this comes back to the ARM-based chips, which I'm just trying to remember. Can you remember what it stands for, Bill? It's like advanced research.
It goes back to the Archimedes, the Acorn, when Acorns became ARM. We were talking about this earlier.
Advanced Risk Machine.
Yeah, Risk Machine.
There we go, because the risk being reduced instruction set computing, which took us back to looking at this, Cambridge University and 1970. And then, Acorn Group adopted that technology in the 80s, which was
my first couple of years as a journalist writing about technology, I went up to Cambridge to meet the guys at Acorn, who at that time were pitching for the business of the BBC microcomputer. But I mean, a lot of people will remember the BBC micro as perhaps their first micro. And
I use them at school.
Yeah, well, they had They had some their research labs in Cambridge, which was at Market Square. It was literally above a shop in Market Square in Cambridge, and I went in there, and there was probably, I don't know, 15 to 20 people, and their offices weren't that big. You know, the research lab wasn't that big, but what was going on in it was literally the start of this revolution, which became ARM, which has changed processes dramatically. And if you think back to probably would be the late 80s when IBM started putting RISC machines, RISC chips in their machines. And I think Apple had an early RISC. The PowerPC was a RISC machine as well back then. But they kind of weren't really – I mean, Intel managed to surge ahead of that generation of RISC machines. But over the last, 15 years – the balance has definitely swung in favour of RISC. So it took that long for the technology to dominate.
It's dominated on mobile devices, hasn't it? It's really for a very, very long time. You know, all our smartphones have been, largely RISC based.
And there would have been times when you're probably thinking that my phone is more powerful than my laptop. Until probably the last 2 or 3 years, you'd be sometimes thinking that and wondering if you could just put that phone chip into your laptop, if it would be faster. Well, this shows it was the case. It absolutely was the case.
Now, it used to be this saying we'd hear from Steve Jobs telling Microsoft to start their photocopiers. Remember that one? And this was this sort of, talk around, Apple shows off their newest thing and then, Microsoft are going to, try and copy it because they talked about Windows being a copy of, the Mac operating system and so on. If you sort of look at it through that lens, actually Apple really led the way here. Apple were the one that took, the ARM processes, and by buying up a chip maker as they did, and then initially getting it so they would make the very best of chips for their phones and their tablets and so on. I guess at times debatable whether theirs have always had the best performance, but anyway, they've had their own kind of custom silicon on that front, obviously for a long time now, but they were really the first that managed to make the ARM chips really work well when it comes to a full blown computer, certainly the laptop. They got that piece right. Now you could argue and say, well, actually, Microsoft went there earlier with their, we go back to the surface, what was the early?
Oh, the first surfaces, yes.
The early surfaces. So, you know, one of those was an ARM-based machine, but unfortunately it just didn't work. But it's in this case you can say, well, Apple led the way with making these, you know, smartphone chips work in laptops and you know, massive profits off them as well. But today is the day that really Windows and PC makers catch up, and is the day where, you know, going forward from here, Intel will be feeling a lot of pain because you know, some quiet chats with the you know, the main brands of PC makers, they are moving from yesterday where their laptops, they had a choice of Intel or AMD chips to three suppliers, and that could well increase over time as more, you know, ARM chips come into the market, but certainly with the Qualcomm chips. So they've got that choice of three chips. Microsoft have not only got, you know, Windows and all of their apps running well on ARM, they've got Opera browser as across, Google have come across, you know, Adobe have come across, all of, you know, these software vendors are ready. Whereas if we look back over the, you know, umpteen years that since when Microsoft first made Windows to run on these ARM chips, it just wasn't a great proposition.
No, but I have one of those early surfaces. I mean, on the one hand, I loved it.
Yeah.
Right. I thought it was great. On the other hand, it was frustrating.
Yeah.
And yet you could see its potential even then, that this was coming. I think you're right. I went to Sydney. We were talking about earlier, we went on that trip to HP to their launch in Sydney. And I went to Sydney, and when I first got the invitation and I looked at it and I read the material, I thought, yeah, okay, so what they're doing here is they're going to AI wash their laptop range. They're going to stick the AI label on it and hope that sells these things. And actually, when you get to see them, and you get to see, and we saw what HP were doing with them, you realize that no, that's not the case. There really is something special happening. And they were putting, and the key to that was the fact they were putting the neural processor into the machines as well. So it wasn't just a sort of marketing exercise. It's a real thing. But those Intel-based AI PCs were kind of like I said earlier, the John the Baptist getting us ready for the real thing, which is happening now. And I think you're right. I think today the PC market changes dramatically. Now, whether that kickstarts a buying cycle or not, because the sales have been in the doldrums for ages, it's another question entirely. My guess is that it will definitely kickstart an enterprise PC buying cycle. If you were a fleet buyer of PC or a sizable organization, you're going to get a lot of benefit out of upgrading your PCs almost immediately.
If it works as well as what we're, you know, what is being suggested, because we've been here before.
We have.
Windows RT initially launched 26th of October 2012. So we're talking 11 and a half years ago that, you know, Windows kind of led the way to, you know, computing based on ARM chips. Yeah. It just never really, you know, over time was able to play out well. Today is the day where all the indications suggest that actually that's flipped. And it's not just what we're hearing today. You know, I've had different bits of feedback from, you know, folks that have had a chance to have a look at the, you know, the new architecture, the performance of these machines. Of course, it's the software coming together. It's the confidence of, you know, just, I mean, the list I saw looking at some of what was coming through from Microsoft, you know, was listing off all the top, you know, computer manufacturers, and everybody seems to be there.
I really want to get my hands on one of those HP or Dells, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think this will be a moment that we look back fondly, and we're very pleased that Intel and AMD, you know, really have some incredibly strong competition today. And yeah, we Now, you talked about sort of a 3-hour versus 20-hour battery life. I'm not sure I've kind of seen quite those extremes. I guess my experience has been, you know, in the direction or not far off sort of 2x battery life if you compare, you know, if you compare a sort of similar device with, you know, similar size battery, all those sorts of things. And, but the difference between the Intel chip and the ARM, you know, is about 2x. It's funny because, you know, I can't remember who it was on Microsoft's presentation, but there was this reference to all-day battery life. Now, we've been hearing this story of all-day battery life for years and years and years, but today it actually comes true.
Well, no, I disagree slightly. I had an early MacBook Air.
Yeah.
There was a point, I think about 10 years ago now, when Intel just did something with the processor that went into the MacBook Air, and it went from a 3-hour battery life to Apple would say 12, right? Yeah. But I got one of these. I went out and bought one of these machines, and at the time, what I was really concerned about was I just struggled to make Windows 8 work for me. I just was really, I was getting so frustrated, and I tried going back to 7, I tried going to Linux, and I thought, I'm going to try a MacBook. And I got a MacBook, and I went out and bought a new MacBook at that point. And it was a MacBook Air. And suddenly I had this machine which I could put it in my bag, backpack or satchel or whatever in the morning, go to work all day, and it wouldn't, the battery would take me through an entire day's work.
Yeah,
I wouldn't need to take a charger in. And that was like a... It was like a turning point, personal turning point for me. That actually made a big difference to me, and so that was about 10 years ago that was actually an Intel processor that did that. With that, at that point, I forget which one it was, but it would just sip power. There was a little bit of an issue with the screen would start to get dark. later in the day.
The power management settings would certainly kick in if you wanted to get that full length, right? And you are right. And look, even, you know, today I'm looking at a list of Windows-based laptops that will give you, you know, 10 hours plus in battery life. And look, there are quite a number out there, but when you compare them against the MacBooks, the MacBooks are next level. Now, it does depend on what you're doing, right? Are you gaming? Are you doing something that uses a whole lot of grunt? Have you got 100 tabs open in your browser that are all sucking a little bit of, you know, the processor and so on? Or are you running things in a nice, tidy, efficient way?
Paul, you're only
sipping power.
I'm a journalist. I write, and I wasn't even using Word. I was using a text editor. I tend to write in just a basic text when I'm doing work like that. So it was definitely low power apps, but
you're the perfect use case for manufacturers to test their equipment on, because they probably actually get their published times, whereas I think a lot of folks will see the published time and then cut it in half to get the reality for their way of working.
But for me, that worked. I'm not saying it would work for everyone. It certainly wouldn't work if I wanted to start making video calls and things. But it did. But I think that today the Windows technology is taking that same leap forward. That Apple did that really 10 years ago, and it did it, and then it did it in earnest when it switched from Intel to its own silicon, to Apple Silicon. And I think the rest of the world's making that call today. But you know, when we were going out there, and I was looking at the thing in advance again, I was thinking, this isn't going to impress. I mean, this might be impressive, but it looks to me just like they're trying to market something here as opposed to really do something. And I got there and I looked at what they were doing and started talking to people about what was happening and so on, and realized that this actually was some kind of turning point. Even then, it was quite clear that we'd hit this kind of point where things change. I don't think the PC is ever going to be back to the dominant role it was when, you know, before we all started using our phones all the time instead.
Yeah.
But I do think this is almost like a fresh dawn. It's a reboot of the sector.
Now, the other piece of the puzzle that fits in here, we talked about Windows, is Windows or these devices are being referred to as Copilot Plus sort of Windows devices, right? So these new ones will need to meet sort of, you know, certain specifications when, you know, when it comes to achieving, you know, the other capabilities, which is the AI side. So on the battery side, look, it seems like Arm have got that sewn up, but we're going to see ongoing competition between Intel and Arm in all the other areas, and even in the battery life area. And I'm sure, you know, Intel have some things up their sleeve as they're sort of shrinking down the dies, making the chips sort of smaller and more efficient, and, you know, whatever else that they can do to compete. But we've also got now this on-device AI, and I think from, you know, some of the conversations over the, you know, recent period, you know, we'd been given a little bit of heads up from, you know, from a few folks kind of off the record around, hey, the vendors were going to go to the Arm chips en masse, which has been confirmed today. And then the other one was that we might just see something more interesting when it came to on-device AI. And today we're seeing that. So some of the things that we're hearing about is that Copilot locally will be able to do a level of summarization, that sort of thing that we've seen. We are going to see Windows with some built-in capabilities around live capturing and translation, I believe. So, you know, you've had some of those capabilities, say, within Microsoft Teams. Now they're moving that to an operating system level, so you could use any tool, and those smarts will be going on. And then, you know, a whole range of other bits and pieces, I'm sure, that will evolve. One of the demos they showed was, you know, if you're in just Windows Explorer managing files, you can right-click on an image and say, remove the background. And that, you know, that just happens right there on your device without the data going anywhere, using the AI chip, or, you know, right-click, ask for sort of variations on that photo.
Well, I think there's a couple of things in there. First is, I think that the whole idea of it being Copilot PCs and so on is really about Microsoft seeking to seize that agenda, you know, to make sure that its branding is in there front and central. And that's fair enough. That's, you know, that's business. That's how these things work. But what's curious about that is that one of the things that came out from the event in Sydney was part of the reason people are buying AI PCs is because the cost of sending workloads to the cloud had started to really rock up.
Yeah.
You know, and guess who the second biggest cloud vendor is? It's Microsoft. So they're in a curious position where they win if you send the work to the cloud, and they win if you don't send the work to the cloud, which is a really interesting position to be in.
And I guess this comes into, you know, the old saying of sort of disrupt thyself. Because, yeah, I sort of, you know, struggled for a while to get my head around, you know, the possibility of doing, you know, much processing, AI processing locally. And look, I'm still not clear on how this plays out over the longer term. You know, how much can you run on your local machine with sort of smaller, you know, data sets and so on? How much or which functions are going to make sense to do in the cloud? And I guess where I'm landing at the moment in my thinking is there will be some, and this will probably be mostly seamless to the user, there'll be some functions that will happen locally, remove the background from that image. Oh, that can be done easily locally. There's no need for a software vendor, et cetera, to move your data, you know, online to do it, move it back again. But there's going to be probably some blurry lines in terms of where you draw that line, and it might just depend on, you know, whose software, you know, who the vendor is as to how much, you know, is done in the cloud. But ultimately, in most cases, for the software vendor, it's going to cost them more to do it in the cloud if it can be done locally. So it's probably going to come down to that.
There's that. And the other thing is I looked into what I would describe as not quite so large language models as well, which is that the large language models, which people talk about with AI and machine learning are they're extraordinarily, I mean, they are. They're what they say. They're large. But inside that largeness, there's quite a lot of junk, and they can be quite inefficient. So what's apparently what can be done is you can make much more efficient language models, which are not quite so large, which will fit comfortably on a on a laptop. So I mean, and particularly if you're working in a particular domain, you don't need everything. So you can have a domain specific model running locally. So if, say, you're some kind of engineer, you could have a model which relates to that engineering topic running locally. And then if you need to go and pull down, I don't know, something from another knowledge domain, you can do that perhaps in the cloud. So there's some flexibility in it. What came out of that HP thing was that there's actually demand for people wanting to run language models locally, not just because of the costs of the cloud, although the cloud, apparently cloud costs for AI processing have gone up a lot in recent years. But the other thing I was hearing about there was the security of sending your data off to...
Privacy is so important, increasingly so.
And so by keeping it all on, you know, locally, you've got things like data sovereignty to worry about. You've got security to worry about, or you don't have them to worry about because the data's not going anywhere else.
Yeah, and look, this has been a big push, you know, within businesses, within organisations who want to keep their data private. They don't necessarily want to drop it out there with sort of ChatGPT. And there are options, you know, with say, you know, Microsoft's premium co-pilots that will, you know, keep that data, you know, private within your tenant rather than it, you know, landing somewhere else for those organizations that are running, say, a Microsoft 365, and, you know, similar things from other vendors. But look, the next level is that the data never leaves your machine. And so as long as you're, and of course there is a as long as element here, as long as your device is kept secure and isn't being accessed and isn't leaking data, then you have that privacy. We're yet to see the you know, the court cases, as we've seen the evidence in sort of past murder trials and things like this of, oh, we went back through their device and they were searching for, you know, poisons that couldn't be, you know, detected and things like that. These are the questions people, I'm presuming, in the future will be asking of their AI. I guess someone in that sort of position is more likely to ask their local AI than their cloud-connected one that's going to keep a record of their request. If those sort of people, you know, think that far ahead.
And another aspect of having it locally is latency. So if you're running, say, something to do with video editing or audio editing or whatever, and you're doing that in real time, you don't want that to head off to, I don't know, some cloud server in Arizona. And, I mean, although it's going to happen fast, it's not going to happen fast enough for real time video rendering, which you can do locally.
Yep. One thing which we could probably go into a big sort of deep, you know, deep look at is, what does all this mean for Intel? And we would probably blow another hour or two if we sort of delve deeply into that. But it was interesting to see that if you look back over 12 months, so this time a year ago, Intel stock has risen a lot but then come back down. So we're 6% up on where their stock was a year ago. I think part of the reason it's come down, because it was up quite high. Even if we look at end of December, their stock was around $50 versus 32 today. I think a lot of this information has been kind of, you know, filtering out. Apparently today, with these announcements, you know, their stock's actually gone up, you know, 1% compared to yesterday. So I don't know if that's investors think this news isn't as big as some might have predicted.
I think it was probably already built in. I think Intel's bad news is all in now, as of today.
There's probably not a lot more coming.
Yeah, I don't think there's much more bad news for Intel.
Yeah.
As I was saying earlier, there's definitely been – I definitely have this sense of there having been a long-term, slow, steady decline in Intel. And I can't think back to when that started, but I've definitely had this kind of – because I've been writing about technology for so long, I definitely had this feeling that Intel was no longer, you know, it's no longer cutting edge or relevant. And the last time I had, well, not the last time I had this feeling, but another time I had this feeling that in a way that would relate to lots of people listening, is it happened with IBM. You know, that there was a point where I was writing about technology and IBM just seemed invincible and a fortress that was never going to be breached, and that got that feeling with Intel during the Wintel days. And then suddenly you wake up one day and you realize, well, actually, IBM's not number one anymore and it's not dominant. And today IBM is still around. It's not irrelevant, but it's no longer cutting edge or anything. And I think Intel's in that kind of space. But it's in a different sector, and it's in a sector where it may be as simple as being able to leap forward a generation in its chip technology. It may just be that simple for them. But I get the impression that Intel definitely lost it somewhere probably about a decade ago.
Yeah, they have really struggled. It'll be interesting because I've heard very positive things, you know, around their current chief executive from, you know, inside Intel. I think, you know, there's certainly been, you know, a new level of energy there. But look, there's a reality here, and I guess going back to your IBM mention, where, you know, technology companies can lead the way and be very dominant for a long period of time, almost inevitably, at some point, someone comes along and beats them in one area or another. Now, the question is whether that becomes a game changer and destroys them or not. You know, the smartest, and I don't know if you can call a company smart because it all, you know, it comes down to the people. But those that have, you know, that have the sort of, you know, longest running, you know, success, they're continuing to, you know, innovate, reinvent themselves. Yeah. Sometimes that means that they're killing off what might have been their golden goose with another product. And look, you know, possibly Intel have just missed some really important opportunities and will never ever get back, you know, to their former heights, and that it's a downhill from here.
Well, it's two cases that are not IBM or Intel that I can think of. One is Apple came back from the dead, and basically it was the iPod. Mm. You know, not the iPad, but the iPod, the little, you know, which was in effect a tiny hard drive, which saved Apple, and it was that close to dead when that came along. And it wasn't as dead, but there was a point where suddenly Microsoft was not relevant at all and going nowhere. And
their share price was flat for an entire decade, probably even longer, right? So completely flat. And here now they are, they've, you know, more than 10x up on some of those old numbers.
I mean, and the last days of Steve Ballmer, you thought, this company is just doomed. And along came the new boss, Nadella, and, you know, it's there. So it can happen. So, it's not necessarily curtains for Intel. I think Intel is in a better place than Apple was when it got to its rock bottom. But it's in a much worse place than Microsoft was at its rock bottom.
Mm.
But it's somewhere between those two.
Mm-hmm. Oh well, we will look on and we will watch, and look, it will be all the better for the sector if Intel are able to, you know, really come back very strongly and compete, and, you know, obviously for all those folks that work at Intel and, you know, have poured their lives into developing Intel software and so on, because that could be a bit of pain changing from one technology to another, but by all accounts, a lot of the Intel, you know, code written for Intel will run quite reasonably on these new ARM-based Windows machines. Look, Bill, just one quick topic before we finish up. You shared with me a link. 38% of web pages that existed in 2013 are no longer accessible a decade later. Not something we think about much, but you know, this has sort of consequences in terms of, you know, documented history that disappeared that was maybe a lot less likely to do so when things were on paper. You know, we often sort of capture links, and you know, whether it's on content that you publish online. I think, yeah, you were saying before we started that you know, when you replatformed your website, there were all these outgoing links that, you know, when they were reviewed, there was hundreds that were that actually were now broken links. You know, organizations and their documentation might refer back to online articles that then, you know, that maybe tell them, you know, how to solve a technical problem or, you know, how to install some technology. Those things become, you know, completely useless when those links are broken. Is this a big deal to you?
Oh, absolutely. Look, we know what people had for meals in ancient Egypt because it's written down on bits of papyrus. I think the Sumerians wrote a customer complaint letter in Sumeria 2,000 years before Christ. So it's like, you know, 3,000 or 4,000 years ago, we've got records of what happened then. We don't have records of things that happened in 2013 because the web pages have gone.
Yeah.
You know, and they may be stored somewhere on the Wayback Machine, you know, the Internet Archive.
Yeah.
They may be stored on some people's hard drives in some form or other. But a lot of that is just dead to us, it's lost to us, and there will be important stuff, valuable stuff. This sounds like it's a complete diversion, but it's not. I've been looking to buy a home server, a media server, and I wanted one. I didn't want to get one of these fancy NAS things with like many bays and needed to run Linux or whatever. I just wanted a basic thing. So I went out and bought a MyCloud, and it's a product that's been discontinued, but I managed to find one on Amazon that was still in its box and new, and I bought one. The support pages have gone.
Wow.
There is some support still there, but there's quite a lot of links on the Western Digital support website to support for this product. And if you click on the link, it's a 404 page. It's gone, right? This product is what has been... It's not been on sale for perhaps 4 or 5 years, but four years ago they were selling these things in shops, and it's history. It's documentation, isn't there? I mean, get me wrong. There's plenty of documentation around.
But this is the reality we live in, isn't it? And I think, you know, you mentioned the Wayback Machine, and that's great. But you know, this is a charitable effort. We have no idea whether it will still be online, how much history, you know, it keeps, and it's quite variable. And from what I recall, the way that it sort of operates is what we used to call, you know, a bit of a Heath Robinson sort of type approach.
And
of,
they
you
get
know,
copyright takedowns all the time. As
technology
well.
Kind of, you know, stuck together in a loose way. And if all of that is, if that's the reality, you know, it only takes one cyber attack that's successful to get through to them, right? Yeah. Somebody that wants to erase history.
I know, but plenty of people with that capability.
And you could wipe, you know, you could see that whole thing, you know, wiped out, and then that's gone as well. So it is a, you know, probably a genuine thing that some, you know, some rich billionaires need to put their heads together on, you know, for us at some point. Or put their at least put their hands into their pockets and you know, put a bit more money into thinking about the longer term play for archiving.
I have to admit, when I found that some of those links that are broken on my site, I could link back to the Internet Archive, to the Wayback Machine. I sent them $50.
Yeah,
you know, I thought, well, $50 might keep you going another few hours, but I was just going to do that, and I would recommend people do that. Actually, it's a brilliant resource, but look, that business with Linkrot, it's a nightmare. I mean,
Linkrot, that's what you call it. Okay,
Linkrot, it's Linkrot. The links aren't there. if I go to my website and I check the links, the broken links on my website, I could go there now probably and find there'll be 20 broken links. Mm. And they'll all be things that have been taken down. It's probably about 6 weeks since I last looked. So probably in 6 weeks, I would imagine about 20 links would have gone. That's, you know, there's still probably 4,000 links left.
Yep.
But at one point I had 9,000 links. Mm. So it's, you know what I'm saying? It's a slow death of something.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's not a good thing.
No, definitely a problem. Well, thanks, Bill. Thanks for joining NZ Tech Podcast today. Always good to catch up and to discuss all these topics. And thanks, everyone, for listening in. Of course, a reminder, if you're listening to the audio, which actually we didn't do live stream this week, so that's all of you, do make sure you follow us across on the social channels if you'd like to catch those videos that we do put out most weeks. In terms of live stream, that's your way to get the news, as it's very live and hot off the press before the audio, usually a few hours ahead of when the audio goes up. So you can find us there on the likes of YouTube, Facebook and X, and also under NZ Tech Podcast, and also by following myself, Paul Spain, on those channels. And, yeah, big thank you, of course, to the show partners, Guerrilla Technology, HP Spark, 2Degrees and 1NZ. Now, Bill, back to you. Where can people find your content at the moment? What's your website link and so on?
It's billbennett.co.nz. It's still there. Most of the links still work. and I don't spend so much time on social media these days. I do have a Blue Sky account, but I can't remember the handle. I think it's probably just Bill Bennett.
Yeah.
And I'm on Mastodon as well. But I haven't made up my mind which one of those two is the place I'm going to end up. Maybe both.
Yep. Fair enough. Thanks again for your insights today. And, thanks everyone for listening. We'll catch you all again next week. See ya.
The New Zealand Tech Podcast. Brought to you by Guerrilla Technology, proactive and strategic IT.